Well, actually, this is a great time. Obviously, we're just delighted to have you here, but before we actually got started, it's a wonderful chance. Not only I got to single out Cece for all the work she did on this, but we also have Guy Woolston, who's one of our staff economists, who I think was Cece's right-hand person on this. So we had a good five people there at the thing today, all of our junior staff that have been working on this. So, and I had one woman in the elevator. She said, "You mentioned Kraft Foods. That was my box."
Does she have a box?
Well, actually, let me get started. So, as I mentioned at the end, I think a big part of what today's forum about is information, that a big part of getting firms over the hump is just kind of figuring out what best practices are, getting those firms that are on the front line of this doing these kind of things and making it known that it works for productivity, making it known. Beth, you were the best. You are living proof for how fabulous this is. I can see why I want to hold on to you with everything we've got. But I think that, to have people out there say how much it means to them and to have the company saying that it means a lot to us is just, I think, unbelievably valuable. So I think I'm thrilled that we have lots of people here that can bring this kind of expertise. So what we want to do, Cece and I are just going to, I think, just have a very free-flowing conversation. It is all being live web feed, something that we do a lot here in the Obama administration, and I think it is a fabulous way to get this information out. So I think that is fabulous. So what I thought would really be nice for us, and I promise not to remember everyone's name, but I'd love to just go around the room and give us a little bit of a sense of who you are and sort of what your relationship is. Or before we jump into the topic, give us a little bit of a sense of who's in the room so everybody else knows kind of where the conversation may go. So why don't we start with you?
My name is Donnie Miller. I'm here representing the Ohio Council of Women and Girls. I'm also CEO of a neighborhood health a federally qualified health center system in Northwest Ohio.
Fabulous.
And I'm Joan Blades. I'm a co-founder of MomsRising.org. We work on economic security for families and also have a book coming out for Labor Day, of course. I'm an organizer, called The Custom Fit Workplace, Choose When, How, and Where to Work and Boost Your Bottom Line.
I'm Susan Molinari. I'm actually a former member of Congress, now work at the firm of Bracewell and Giuliani. I think I'm here despite the fact that I'm a Republican, but because this is one of those issues that I think does unite both political parties, and everybody understands that good business is good politics, and clearly, as Coke can tell you, back in the day, that was the women always worked together because we understood the sensitivities of these issues, and so I'm just honored to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you.
I'm Leslie Perlow. I'm on the faculty of the Harvard Business School, and I've spent many years trying to work with organizations and create change and document it as part of the process as well, in particular right now, professional service firms.
Doing experiments, right?
Doing experiments.
That's right. That's just what we need.
Hi, I'm Kim Williams. I'm here representing the corporations. I'm with GlaxoSmithKline.
I'm Linda McAleer. I'm the president of the Melior Group, which is a marketing research company in Philadelphia across the river from Camden, New Jersey. And I also am the vice chair of the board of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. So some of the issues that I'm interested in addition to the small business issues, are those with people with disabilities and workplace flexibility and how that works.
I'm Shelley McDermott-Wadsworth. I'm a professor at Purdue University. I've studied issues related to working conditions and family life for the last 20 years, and for the last 10 years I've been focusing especially on military families.
Hi, my name is Steve Fusell. I'm the head of human resources for Abbott, a Chicago-based company, who for a long time in this space believed that the extension of our care to our customers and patients begins with the way we treat each other, and the sort of environment that we build to make that happen every day in 130 markets around the world. So.
Hi, my name is Jody Thompson, and I'm the co-creator of the Results Only Work Environment and author of the book, Why Work Sucks and How to Fix It. And our whole change is to stop talking about flexibility and start talking about results. So in a results-only work environment, nobody has to be afraid to ask their manager permission, because the managers don't have the right anymore to give or take flexibility away. So every single person is included, and every single person gets to live the life they want to live.
Sounds good to me. I'm Cokie Roberts. I'm a journalist at ABC and NPR, but I've also written several books and written a great deal about these issues. I've also been a working mother for 41 years, and now I'm a working daughter. So it is, you know, the life that, that I've lived. But in recent days, I actually sort of showed up on Valerie Jarrett's doorstep and said, we need to talk about this Council on Women and Girls and get it going and move it along. And that I feel very strongly that these issues are all about productivity and competition for the United States of America, regardless of whether it's been
I'm Randy Irwin. I'm with the National Federation of Federal Employees. We're the oldest federal employee union, and represent a lot of workers in DOD, the Forest Service, the Passport Service, and we're working on a lot of legislation and things to, you know, make the federal workforce, you know, a model employer to have, you know, and get some more of these kind of flexibilities, and hopefully make the federal workforce more productive.
I'm Ashley Carson. I'm the executive director of OWL, founded as the Older Women's League. We work on health, economic security, and quality of life for women 40 plus. I also co-chair with Heidi Hartman, the Older Women's Economic Security Task Force for the National Council of Women's Organizations.
Hi, and I'm Heidi Hartman. I'm the secretary-treasurer of the National Council of Women's Organizations, and I'll just mention that that's a coalition of about 200 organizations that represents 12 million women. But what I do every day is run the Institute of Women's Policy Research, which is a think tank here in Washington, D.C., and we work a lot on workplace flexibility issues. Also, EEO and general economic security issues, everything from child care to social security, kind of cradle to grave economic issues.
Hi. My name is Avis Jones DeWeaver. I'm the director of the Research Policy and Information Center at the National Council of Negro Women. And as the numbers go, black women are, of course, disproportionately represented in the low-wage labor force. And because this is an issue that is a particular challenge in that sector, we're really happy to be here and really happy to explore ideas that could make workplace flexibility a reality in their lives.
Hi, I'm Portia Wu. I'm Vice President at the National Partnership for Women and Families. We helped lead the coalition that got the Family and Medical Leave Act passed before, and we are spearheading the work on the Healthy Families Act, so we're thrilled to hear the First Lady mention that. And generally, we work on a lot of work, family, and workplace fairness legislation.
I'm Arlene Holt-Baker, and I'm the Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, and certainly representing 11.5 million members, we have addressed the issue of flexibility in numerous contracts, thousands and thousands of contracts, and more we see it as a major issue at the bargaining table. And I just want to add, in addition to that, particularly here to also talk about what's happening, because we too are very interested in what we see happening to low-wage workers who certainly do not have not even sick leave. So certainly to talk about legislative ways in which we could help to make life a little bit better.
I'm Ellen Galinsky, the president of the Families and Work Institute. We are a research organization that studies the changing workforce, family, and community. We do a nationally representative study of the U.S. workforce that the Department of Labor used to do in the 70s, and we've done since the 90s. We have three decades of data on how the workforce has changed. And in 1998, we began a study of how employers have changed, and are so pleased that our data were helpful to you all in your report. About 7 years ago, the Sloan Foundation came to us and said, we have a lot of research on what we know matters to employees and employers. Let's see it taken to action. We began then a project that is now in 26 communities in 5 states, where we are, it's a change experiment looking at how to implement effective and flexible workplaces. Where we have 1,000 companies last year, small and mid-sized and large, low wage, across the spectrum, applying for an award that's research-based, where we really do keep track of some of the best practice that's happening in the country, and it's free and it's on our web.
I held up ours. You can help.
I'm Lauren McFerrin. I'm the Acting Chief Labor Counsel for Senator Harkin on the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions.
I'm Jim Turley. I'm the Chairman and CEO of Ernst & Young. I feel like a piker. If Arlene's got 11.5 million people, we only have 150,000 employees around the world. But it was great to be here. When I'm not active with Ernst & Young, I actually am also the chair of the Catalyst organization. Leading organizations, I am biased, but one of the leading organizations for the advancement of women in business.
Right. Let's see back here. Doug and Beth.
Somebody right. Catherine Steve, the Washington Reporter from Chicago City. Yep.
And certainly we have Nan Gibson from the CEA here, and Guy. How about over here?
I'm just an intern.
Have you join us?
Sorry.
No, it's lovely. You know, actually, I thought I would kick it off. Sort of the idea of this, I mean, to the degree we have a topic for today, it's actually talking about best practices. I think what Koki was mentioning about what do flexibility practices bring to productivity, to the bottom line, the benefits for workers. I think all of that is a great topic of discussion. You know, when I think about the Council of Economic Advisors, we really are a small business, right? So we are 40 people, and you know, I think, and we're probably the ultimate results-only work environment in the sense that what matters is, you know, do you get something like this written or not? And I can't tell you the number of times, you know, I've had a senior economist say, I think I'm going to work at home today because I have a lot of work to do, right? That's actually, you know, can often be, and I know I will sometimes say, you know, I have a speech to write, I'm going home early, because often you can be even more productive. And I think, you know, embracing that has been just incredibly important. Or I love to, you know, we've got the ultimate, we've got huge amount to do, huge hours. We've got some people that like to get here at 7:30. You know, my chief forecaster bikes in every day at 11, but he's here at 9 o'clock every night. It works perfectly for us. And I think that, you know, getting over the, you know, it does feel like a hump of just people are used to the 9 to 5, and if you don't shake them out of it, sometimes they might just keep going there. So that's why I think it'll be great to have this discussion. And maybe James, would you like to kick us off? I know that your firm is some pretty progressive or pretty far along in these policies. What's been your experience?
How's it working? Thank you, I guess. We are far along. We've worked very hard on it. But as Doug said earlier in the session, like Kim, we have a long way to go. We realized about a decade ago, you know, with 150,000 people, unlike some of the other great companies around the table, we have no assets at all that don't go home every night, okay? So we don't have plants and machinery and equipment and patents, but every asset we have goes home every night. We want to be the kind of place that they come back to the next day. And so it became incredibly important to culturally, both around women and men, be that kind of place. We saw a decade ago that our women were leaving us more quickly and earlier in their careers than our men were. For all the reasons that were talked about earlier. So we embarked on a lot of things. Flexibility was the most important issue for both women and men. Since that time, we've confronted it on a couple dimensions. One is programmatic. You know, you've got to have the technology, the processes, you know, the BlackBerries, the work from home technology, all this has to be enabled. But, you know, as Doug said earlier, the most important piece is the culture. The most important piece is actually getting it right. It's built on trust, it's built on teaming, it's built on respect. And that's been sort of what we've been really focused on. You know, lots of consistent messages, lots of programs, lots of training, lots of sort of meetings in a box that different business units could hold to talk to their people, because you had to overcome some resistance. We actually put in place a culture that at the time we called people first. You know, and people, oh, come on, you're really going to think about our people first? You know, this is a very demanding profession. We've got clients everywhere. Clients are highly demanding. And what it meant was that we were going to think first in every business decision about the impact on our people. Not that that was going to solely drive the decision and that everybody could sit on the beach every day, but that we would think about it, listen to our people, and then factor that in heavily in our decisions. And it actually led us to a lot of the cultural changes that that have been amazingly effective. What was really helpful as well was getting over the hump of being honest with each other. I remember sitting down with a group of young men and women in Texas in our Houston office and having them say, you know, there was this partner, you know, a man 8 years ago or something, and he'd be going, leaving the client team at 4 o'clock. They all thought he was going, he's an important guy, he's going to another client, he's going to a dinner with some other client, he's going home to watch his daughter play soccer. And as soon as that became honest, spoken, then it becomes okay for, you know, this young woman and that young man to admit they have lives too. And so pretty soon, as we all got honest with each other, then the teams started working out what's important to you, what's important to you, how could we back you up, how could you back me up? And it relatively quickly, you gotta be consistent on it, but it relatively quickly moved from the only authorized things to do were children and aging parents to everything is authorized. And the reason someone wants flexibility is not relevant. If someone wants to train for a marathon, if someone wants to maybe have a date, if someone wants to do something else, fine. Let's find out what's important to people, and the team then embraces it and backs the people up. And it's made an enormous difference. Someone talked about results. The results, you know, like Doug's company at Campbell's, the retention of our people, incredibly positive. The engagement of our people on every measure, incredibly positive. Fortune
magazine. They have a spring in their step.
Yeah, I can't measure the springs as much, but it's been spectacular. And you know, Fortune's best place to work, a dozen years in a row, the highest ranking in our profession, you know, consistently, despite the trouble of last year's economy, improved on the list, the rest of the profession went backwards on the list. So we feel that the ROI is just off the charts positive for us. So, but it's a lot more about culture than it is about programs.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Is this a written policy or is it less formal?
There are written policies that back it up, but it's mostly cultural. You know, some of the sort of written things that we had to sort of get communicated were actually around our expectations of our people. We all work crazy hours. You talked about some coming in and riding in 11. I'm an early morning person, and I travel around the world all the time. And so I'll leave messages for people at the strangest hours of the day and night. But we had to make it clear to all of our people that it's just fine for you to leave a message for someone you work with at midnight if that's when you want to be working, but you've got no right to expect that they're going to be listening to it at that time of day. And so it really became clear about the expectations of reply. And so some of those things were more structured.
Gopi, I mean, I'd love to hear your perceptions about this. As you mentioned, a passion of yours. Can you give us maybe some background?
I really, you know, in looking ahead, one of you down there talked about public policy parts of it. And as Susan indicated, I've covered it a lot. And then the women in Congress really do still. I mean, they're the only little islands of bipartisanship in the Congress. The women do get together to try to do things that are of use for women, children, and families. And family leave, of course, was huge. And we talk about people not even having sick days, and you know, and that was at least an unpaid sick day, you know. But as the as time has gone on, and I continue to look at it now, looking at the statistics that we have in front of us, more than half of the people graduating from college are female. 2/3 of the people graduating from graduate school are female. If we have a workplace that is unfriendly to the best and the brightest, by which I mean female, this is what we're looking at. That is going to have an impact on our whole economic situation. Yes. And it seems to me that that's the way we sell this. I mean, yes, it's nice. It would have been lovely for me to have had more flexible time, although I was really glad there was no maternity leave. I could go right back to work and not be with that baby. but so much easier. And it's very hard to get people to just do the right thing because it's the right thing. But to get people to do the right thing because it's the economically sensible thing seems to me to be the pitch to make. And I really do believe that it's true in terms of competitiveness, but it's also just true in terms of it being sanity and the right thing to do. It's just crazy not to be able to be at home when that works. But I do see the true problem for the low-income workers, because that is where, if they don't show up, they get fired. And what's their choice? Leave a kid home sick by themselves, or, you know, show up at work? I mean, that's often the choice. And it's all fine and good to talk about telecommuting, but it doesn't work at the beauty parlor, and it doesn't work on the assembly line, and it doesn't work when public schools send your children home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon without telling you, all of that. And that's where sometimes public policy has to come into action. And so I think that we have to think in those terms as well, as much as business needs that.
So as I've been listening to all this, it's really exciting that we're on this subject. There's one piece that hasn't come up, and I want to make sure it gets on the table while we're having, because I love the work Jody and Kylie do, and we're talking about all kinds of flexibility. The one thing, taking babies to work for the first 6 months, babies at the workplace, it's really, now not all jobs can do it, but for low-wage workers, because we are this unique country that has no paid leave for new mothers, out of over 170.
Right.
For low-wage workers, there's a difference between being able to take care of your child and put food on the table. And it's working very successfully. Now, this is the interesting thing. Women have been doing this for thousands of years. Women and men can do this. And in the right workplace, it's proving very successful. There's a babies in the workplace program that gives you guidelines. And for a huge segment of the workforce, for this one very discrete period of time, it's a wonderful benefit. And that goes from low wage to top wage workers, just making all the difference in the world.
I wonder, what do the business people think about that?
Can I ask, are you talking about daycare?
No,
or having
not
daycare
about
services
daycare.
Or on site, which is a big issue.
For your baby, when you go to work, learning how to breastfeed while working at the computer or being on the phone.
We love multitasking, however.
How far?
It doesn't sound like Cokie wanted to do that. I can just see you on television.
That another step to take is to, why don't you just let women be wherever they want to be and still work? So for example, I worked for a company a long time ago, and when I came in, they said, you get 6 months of sick time. And I said, in my entire life or what? And they said, no, you just get 6 months of sick time. And I didn't understand it, but basically what they were saying was, just take the time you need whenever you need it, as long as you get the job done.
Yep.
So when I hear things like, we're going to take this big step and you're going to have 7 days of sick time, it makes me sick to my stomach. One of the tenets of Roe is unlimited paid time off as long as you get the work done. And it's, what's interesting about that is companies carry a liability around this stuff, and it has to be managed. But people can actually manage it themselves. And when people are given that authority and they're given that autonomy, they get the work done. And they work together to get the work done. And it's not about tracking time and using my time and feeling like I should be lucky because I have this little bit of a little nugget that you've given me. And so we've worked with companies where they've actually removed vacation time, and the people have all cheered. Because the culture shift is, I would rather work in a company that trusts me and gives me complete freedom than going into a company that says, the first year you get a week off, and only if your boss gives you permission, and only during these times of the year, and only if this person isn't on vacation, and on and on and on and on. So I think that the problem with work today is more about the paternalistic structure of and the belief that people need to be managed and that flexibility needs to be managed. We have to stop managing flexibility. Flexible schedule is an oxymoron. And look at giving people their lives back and giving them the autonomy to make the right decisions, and they do.
All right, so let me, can I push?
Yeah. I think, you know, Cokie asked what the business community thought of the take the babies to work. And I've never thought about that. I'd be intrigued to explore that. I have to admit, I'm anxious about it from a few perspectives, but I'm willing to listen and experiment. And I'm probably more anxious about the lack of productivity from the 10 people that are sitting anywhere near, because they're all involved. Everyone loves other people's right. babies. And so I'm just, yeah, I'd like to think about it and learn about that.
That's why they actually have the Babies in the Workplace program, and they have a whole set of documents where you make a whole set of agreements.
Okay.
And the bottom line is, almost all the organizations, and that goes from small to larger organizations that have done this, you know, banks and places that use clerks for this. I'm not good at remembering all the different ones. But there's an understanding that you're responsible for your baby.
I'd
and if your baby's
more,
disruptive,
but
you have
you
to...
You know what?
Last
really,
point,
just
on your
focus
point about the trusting the employees,
yep.
I think this is critical.
Yes.
The way we changed the culture was there was too much discussion around flexibility, and in people's minds that
right.
morphed into a flexible work arrangement, i.e. a reduced work arrangement for some people. And we totally changed that to flexibility being a right of every one of
exactly.
our people.
Exactly, right.
And flexible work arrangement being a privilege that a few people actually, a minority of people actually agree on some alternative
right.
schedule.
Which gives the manager control over
exactly.
it as well.
Yeah.
Which
so,
is wrong.
I guess the way I want to push, I want to get to you too. The question is, I mean, this all sounds great, and I don't know, I mean, and in some environments, I can certainly understand, you can say, here's what you need to get done, just get it done. It seems. Is that realistic for a whole lot of things? So let me. You look like you're.
I think she had her hand up first.
Well, I think we're talking about these two ideas that are on the table as if one size fits all. And if there's anything that we have learned in the past four decades of this work is that there are principles that fit all, but one size doesn't fit all. So what may work in one environment may not work in another environment. I happened to take my own baby to work. I loved it. But I worked in a university, I could do that. So I think that we really have to get away from the notion. I think that what Jim said, which is trust, and also, I think Doug said that too. It's and you do need policies as a platform often, because it's like having rules that help you learn to walk. And so having some guidelines or rules, as long as they're a two-way street, and we talked about that earlier, and then having the right to go further, but you have to have teams that work out the problems. I mean, I have seen very flexible initiatives with low-wage employees when they can figure out how they can manage the assembly line themselves, and they don't have to do it and pretend that they didn't do it. They can actually do it out in the open, as you described, like
right.
the person who went 4 o'clock. So I really hope that we get away from the discussion of here's the one solution. There are lots of solutions, but they all need to be built on good problem-solving, trust, and teamwork, and accountability.
And I think, and I think the other piece to that is results. Because I think that's the one thing that we're all trying to do, even with flexible schedules, is we're trying to focus on, is the job getting done? So I think that's the common ground. Is the job getting done? Are we trusting people that they're going to do the right thing, no matter where they work or what they do? And when people come to us and say, well, a results-only work environment won't work here, my retort to that is, so in your company, you can't focus on results?
I think Arlene has.
Well, I was just going to say, there are a number of things that you can look at, but I'll just want to speak from the perspective of what we have found to work. And we heard the panel today, a number of them talked about the kind of intimidation and fear that people have in approaching their employer about flex time. And we certainly, that's a reality in the workplace. But one of the things that has been proven to work, and it certainly helps with production, is if the employer and the employees are able to sit down and have a contractual agreement around a number of issues, but in this case, flex time. And we've been able to bargain flex time in a number of our contracts. That's worked well for the employees as well as the employers, and there has not been a loss of productivity. And especially, you know, we've had to think about this differently too, because in the past, you know, you think, well, it's about vacation days and sick days, but then it moves to, it was a time when sick days was only for the individual. Now you have to think about sick days. Can I take sick days to take care of an elderly parent or a child? And so that's contractually, in our cases, we've been able to bargain for that. Adoption, bereavement leave, all of those issues have been bargainable. You had indicated down, you talked about, you know, if you were able to have, everybody could just kind of take their time, if you will, and that is would certainly be an ideal. But for 79% of low-wage workers who happen to be women, they don't get any paid sick days at all, and some of them no sick days, no ability to even take it. So we've got to find a way for those workers who don't have the benefit of having a union that can bargain a contract for them, to get them at least to have some sick leave, and that's where the policy comes in. So 7 days for number of us who are professionals may seem minimum, but if we had 5 or 7 days guaranteed for so many of in our workforce and a policy that supported that, that would go a long way to helping them take care of their families.
Yes, I agree with that. We actually took a curb jump approach with that one.
What does that mean?
It means rather than start with a policy, we said, why would we need a policy? And then we curb jumped over that. So we're working on instituting this in nursing homes right now.
Yeah.
So they have the same problem. Like, we can't get time off, we don't have the benefit and all of that sort of thing, but now they've created a way to shift around and do things different ways so that they can take that time off when they need to and they still get their hours in, because they have complete control over how they approach resident care with everybody in the system. And it's working. We're actually at the National Institute of Health.
I think we need to get some other people to
talk
about
it. Yeah, we will. I was studying that.
Oh, yeah, I did want to say, to echo what those points about policy, absolutely we think that, you know, it's great to talk about this workplace by workplace, but really we need a broader national approach. Some states and localities are going at it, and the national partnership really believes that paid sick days and paid leave is an incredibly important part of that, because there are so many low-wage workers, so many part-time workers, and overwhelmingly those are women, and they need these options. But I do want to talk about one piece. We've talked about cost for employers, and I think one piece, you know, we know it's an economic cost to individual families when they risk losing their jobs or their income. We know that for businesses, they see it as a cost, but we think there are other economic returns in terms of increased productivity, retention, reduced turnover. But increasingly now, there's also our public health cost.
Yes.
And that's sometimes a public health cost in terms of reducing the spread of epidemics with H1N1. But it's also in terms of, for longer term paid leave, being able to care for elderly parents, get them to the doctor, for women being able to take care of not only their family's preventive care, because how many mothers always say, you know, my health care needs come last. I take care of everyone else's appointments first, but women need to be able to go to those preventive appointments themselves. And that's a huge cost savings for us overall as a society.
And add the breastfeeding into, I mean, we're told we're supposed to be breastfeeding for 6 months now. And if you're a low-wage worker, your chance of being able to take that time to, it's tiny. So we really have to figure out alternatives.
So I also think that, I mean, one of the things in the report was when workers have more control over their hours and their lives, they're healthier. So just the stress level, I think, is important. You had something you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to thank you. I'm sorry I don't remember your name. I promise not to remember anyone's name. I love this conversation, and I love all the ideas around the room, but I think that there are a couple of things we have to remember. Companies still have to exist. I mean, you still have to have a structure that supports the fundamental reasons that the companies are there. And what we're really, what we are trying to do, and I work for a community health center system, so when you see the president, tell him that we are deeply in love with him and community, and community health center systems for his generosity to us. We work for, in a community health center system, we are seeing the sickest of the sick, we are seeing the poorest of the poor. You cannot have, we simply cannot have, and I would love to talk to you further about how we can make that happen, but we have to have staff there when we need staff there. We have to have doctors there when we need doctors there. We have patients coming in the door. Now what we've done, because we've been talking about this at our place for a very long time, is that we have taken all of that benefit time and made it your time. So we've combined vacation time, sick time, bereavement time, military leave time, pregnancy time, all of that time is a pot of time. We don't care how you use it. You're absolutely right. We've decided that flexibility is nobody's business. We give you this pot of time. All that pot of time comes with a cost, though, to the company. Remember, when you're away, you're being paid, and that comes with a cost to the company. But we have at least decided that for that pot of time, it's yours. And our obligation as a company is to decide how to cover you when you need to be gone.
And that's a big issue.
That's a big issue.
We are able to do that. But we need to, we work with our staff in order to do that. You have to go to somebody and say, I need to be away. And we don't care why. We just need enough notice to cover your time away.
And so, what has that done in terms of your bottom line?
We're fine. We're fine. And if you're talking about whether it increases whether the culture has changed a bit,
or does it increase
the cost?
It
doesn't really increase
many patients.
It really doesn't increase our cost. It's time that they might have taken anyway. It's time that we had planned for them to take. Whether they took it or not was a different thing. But we'd planned for them to take it. So we built in what we call contingency staff. As somebody mentioned earlier, you know, that you call somebody, that's what we do. We budget contingency staff. So if you're going to be away and we know it, then we call somebody in to cover you and it's already in our budget. So we've pre-planned for that. Cultures are tough to change. They're slow to change. Sometimes after a while, people begin to think it's something that you ought to do as opposed to something that you're, a benefit that you're providing them. So, you know, we constantly keep our staff involved in conversations. And just one other point, we had a program called Summer Hours where we would shift, it's still there. We had longer hours, it's really a compressed work week idea. We have longer hours Monday through Thursday, shorter hours on Friday. And at our staff meeting, we have about 150 people on staff. Staff meeting last week, they asked if they could vote to abolish it because they actually were not having enough time to get their work done. So they wanted the Friday afternoons back.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
That's not
going to
happen, I guess. That's a one-way street.
I was really surprised. I was very surprised
about that.
I think the fascinating and promising part of all of this is that we all share a common passion for advancing not just flexibility in this regard, but the success and pursuit of life and their careers of women and all the constituents of our workforce. I think we also all share, you see around the table, if you're here in these roles, a passion for solving problems. But interestingly enough, what we really found to emphasize a couple of the points made earlier is you've got to understand whoever you represent, what your constituencies are, and be on point. Within our workforce, and it's not unique to the United States, we have a bimodal distribution of people in our company. We've got a ton of people between 25 and 35, and a ton of people between 45 and 55, and 31% less in the middle. So to your point about do you have to do something about this, this is one of the reasons that our interns and entry-level hiring programs are up 60% over the last 4 years during the recession, because I'm not filling jobs I've got today. I'm filling jobs I've got 5 to 7 years from now, in the same way we should be looking at our products that way. But where we had our biggest breakthroughs is when we found out that, unlike my nature, I can't solve all these problems for you, to your point. And that demographic, you let them solve them. If you want to solve the scheduling issues in these sites, well, here's a concept. They have their own pool of rotational workers who are trained on multiple jobs, who are there for call-in. Some of the hourly can figure it out themselves. They actually call them themselves and get them in place. They'll do the work for you. You don't have to figure it out as an employer. If you make these sorts of things available, and candidly, it works in some places, and they're the sorts of jobs that it does work, you know. But I think that's probably the biggest piece. We all have a piece of the constituency for which we'll contribute to the resolution of this problem. There's not a one-size-fits-all. The real key is getting the right people with each element in this solution to focus on what they do best and to recognize, for us, the biggest piece of changing this, we've done a lot with policy. We've done a lot with child care. We train child care workers in the communities in which we work. People bring their kids to work in the environments where we work. But at the end of the day, if you really want to change this stuff, you know, if you want to have the views of women in the leadership of your company, here's a concept. Put some there. If you want to have the views of people, if you want to have the views of people of color in the leadership of your company, here's a concept. Put some there.
And on the board.
And it changes.
And on the board.
It changes. You know, ultimately, that's how it's sustained at the end of the day.
I talked to you about the military and what are some of the challenges the military family
And I have one thing. I realized poor Guy, who's there taking notes, I was supposed to ask people to say their names and their institution again before. So maybe if we'll start that now. I'm sorry.
Well, you might have asked me to undercut one point that I was going to make. One of the things I had wanted to say was that I think a lot of employers believe that doing nothing costs nothing. And that's not true. Doing nothing costs something because you're paying the cost of all those absentees, employees, and all of that. So disabusing them of that. But I also think it's not reasonable to think that everybody should be able to make a profit off of this. We're trying to make work work. We're not necessarily trying to turn flexibility into a profit center. It's nice if that happens, but I don't think that should be the hurdle. What I was going to say was that in my experience as sort of a business manager in a way, as well as a researcher, it seems that flexibility, the success of flexibility in many ways is more about the people doing it than about the job. In other words, some people handle flexibility very well and are very good at managing to results, managing themselves to results, and other people have more skills to learn there. Now, the military is an interesting case in point because they have a mission to do that isn't very flexible. And talk about having to have people, you know, on site, and it's very hard when someone needs to leave because somebody's having a baby, but you happen to be in Iraq and, you know, your baby's in the U.S. But I have to say that I have seen very creative efforts, even within that very difficult structure. For example, the Navy has created sabbatical leave programs for active duty personnel, which I never would have believed. If someone would have told me they were going to do that, I would have said, huh, really? And of course, they do have very generous leave compared to many other employers. And so they're trying in even a very difficult, perhaps one of the most difficult environments, but I think they too understand that if you want access to the full range of employees and they have to compete with private employers, they have to make themselves attractive, and they have to make themselves attractive knowing that they need employees who are willing to promise to die for them if necessary. It's a hard recruitment sell, and they're trying to find ways, I have to say.
Ashley, I think you want
to. I just wanted to piggyback onto your point that we need to emphasize how much it can save companies by offering flexible time or paid sick leave. The MetLife Mature Market Institute did a great study, it's probably referenced in the report, but talking about the annual cost to corporations being $13.4 billion in the employees who are caregivers of children or elderly parents. In their health costs to that company. So when you give them flexible work schedules or access to, you know, paid sick days, they're going to be more productive for the corporations. And I feel that we're all pretty friendly in this room, and the corporations that are represented are very open to these suggestions, which is fantastic, but we're not going to win the fight unless we learn how to talk to the corporations who are not open to hearing these messages. And I think if we get, you know, on message with how much this can actually benefit their bottom line, I think we have a lot better chance of winning. I also think that the Healthy Families Act has got to be, you know, a starting point and the floor. And that, 7 days isn't great, but
you know, the people I represent are women who are working, you know, in nursing homes, who are waitresses, and who are also caring for aging parents and their kids who now can't find jobs or are even younger and still need care. So just trying to reframe the way we're talking to win.
Anyway, that's very helpful. I'd love to ask sort of maybe the various business people or anybody the question of sort of measuring the productivity effects. Is that, you know, when you put these into place, how, you know, how confident are you of how much you save? Like, you know, we cite numbers. Cisco says they saved $195 million. Do you feel confident that you can see it in your bottom line? Or
We are. And we measure it in two or three ways that come to mind immediately. One is we measured the retention of our people.
So that's the 1.3.
And it costs an amazing amount to recruit and train people. And so that is just straight dollar savings. And put aside the sort of resulting client satisfaction that our clients love when people come back year in year, you know, they hate turnover of our staff. So the client, the retention of our people is one clear measure, and it is compelling.
And is that equal for men and women?
It, when we started, it wasn't. Now it is.
Very interesting.
So just a very clear result of this. You know, we also, you know, measure employee engagement. And we have done, you know, there's lots of different surveys around that are very well respected to measure engagement. And we've done a lot of sort of cross-hatching of, you know, around practice units, the level of employee engagement compared to the profitability of the respective business unit. Direct linkage. The more engaged our people are, the better service we deliver to clients, the more money we make. And so we measure that very clearly. And so I think the value proposition is clear. Now, one thing that I always struggle with personally, and you sort of hit on it, that, you know, what should we do with companies that don't get it, that don't understand that? You know, my bias is let them fail. And I'll just be very direct.
I was thinking the same thing.
So I think that we have different issues and probably different beliefs around the table on that. But if a company doesn't believe that embracing workplace flexibility for their workforce is going to be a net positive, we ought to do everything we can to show them the research, show them the best practices. Personal view is I would tend not to mandate it for them because I think that they will learn by their failure. I think that's a debate that you and the administration will need to have.
I think one of the interesting, the interesting ideas is the role of competition. when it doesn't, sure. Show, it's often the firms that don't learn are the ones that, for some reason, don't face the kind of competitive pressure.
You know, can I add one thing to the comment about newsflash? If you want women's view, put women in management. You know, one of the things Catalyst measures a lot of is women representation in boards in the Fortune 500 and senior management. And there is direct correlation between the number of women on boards and ethnic minorities on boards and the number of women in senior leadership, you know, shortly thereafter, and then the women in sort of pipeline to senior leadership coming after that. So it is 100% right that you need to actually, you know, walk the talk and get the voices at the table. The teams in the future, in government, in business, anywhere, are going to be much more diverse than they ever have been in the past. And one of the pieces of research we did found that really diverse teams are rarely mediocre. They're either great or they stink. And it all comes down to whether you have a culture to bring out all the disparate points of view onto the table and get the best answers. Some cultures, that won't work.
Because I think I interrupted Doug over here.
While I was interrupting you, I have a lot to offer, but there's a lot to be offered here. Jim and I are very much on the same wavelength. Businesses are quite good at managing their costs. They understand it, and we see clear benefits in this specific area. And I also would challenge any of our people to, if there was an increase in cost, nobody's been able to show me that there's an increase in cost because we've gone flexible. In fact, I'm happy to challenge anyone in that regard. these groups figure out how to manage it, at least within the cost base they have, if not to be more productive. And so I have not seen a credible argument on that front. The other thing, I agree with you, Ashley, that the need to have the compelling business case for this, and I understand that. But you know what I see is, in our company and other companies I've worked in, is the people join a company, but they leave a manager. And the company may be enlightened on this, and you may try and create a culture, but ultimately it's all about that person,
right.
That SOB
that jerk. Right.
Okay? And that person is not necessarily motivated by how much money the company makes. You know? So we can make all the great business cases in the world. I think it's not as involved in Catalyst as Jim has been, but heavily involved. And we've made the business case. And it's compelling, it's inarguable, but we're still having trouble making progress because the culture and the managers aren't motivated by that. They're motivated by trying, how do I get my work done without screwing up, right? And so you have to deal with this cultural issue that Jim talks about. The business case, quite frankly, is helpful, but wholly insufficient. And I think we just can't lose sight of that because we've been pounding the business case in a pretty compelling way for two decades. And these companies still aren't getting it.
I'm really struck by the sense that we have the wrong people in the room. We need all the guys that don't believe
it. And Jim is right about that too. If they're not getting it, they will pay. There are big consequences to that behavior.
See, I don't believe that. I think that the people, the companies that don't get it won't fail. What you will find if you don't force this, if you don't force a conversation that sounds something like we need to legislate this sort of thing, is that you will find those companies that don't have unions. They will, the women who are most disenfranchised, the workers who are most disenfranchised in this country will work at those places because they have no choices. And so those companies won't fail.
When I say fail, I don't mean go bankrupt. Right. They will be slowly getting more and more marginalized. They will lose market share, and they will lose talent too.
You have to challenge them. I don't disagree with that. They have to be challenged.
I want to get Susan in.
I first fall down more onto the business imperative, and I love when Koki talks about sort of the need for the argument of the competitiveness issue, because I think that's something that we all agree upon is that we don't get into the political, but in every organization, and I bet in yours, and this is where I think is the hinge, because it does come to success, which is why I just absolutely adore that this study came out of your office. I think that is so important that this came out of that office. But you have somebody like Beth, who's a great worker, who is on it, who's loyal to this company, who does everything she possibly can, but she's not in the office from 6 in the morning to... But she's not in the office. We all work alongside and or have to manage your agenda, have answers. The person that could be a female or a male, and that's why I love the fact that you make this not just about childcare, although that's what drives me, but then we get into the whole mommy war thing. The guy that's there and the guy, or could be guy or girl, that's there from 6 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, it says, how does Beth get the promote? How do you maintain the culture in promoting and advancing the person?
You go to what Judy was talking about, it's all about results.
And you have to really then have
nothing
a culture
else.
That defines yeah. that almost well, every day in the world.
I don't agree right. with I don't agree that it's something else, but I do
but it's still about
but
performance.
It's about what are you committed to doing and are you
right.
delivering it? We also believe there's part of it, it's not just the what, it's the how to.
Well, if your question was how do men not feel disenfranchised?
Or women who don't have,
right.
who are, living by themselves and are at the office 24/7 and...
I lived that personally 15 years ago. We were launching a program that was all around some of these issues. It was a mentoring program specifically for women. I launched it in Minnesota. I was leading the practice there. And I lived in fear of this backlash. Sure enough, the next day, a young man comes in my office about 6:30 at night, and he sits down and says, can I talk? Yes. He says, sounds like a neat program, but I feel disadvantaged. And I'm like, oh, dadgummit. And I was worried about this. And I said, this really bothers you, doesn't it? He says, yeah. I said, well, the plain truth is, you're a second-year person in a firm. I'm running this office. Did you have an appointment to see me? No. So let me get straight. Something bothered you. You walked right in my office to talk with me about it. truth of the matter is, a woman in the same circumstance would walk out the door. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't feel comfortable enough to walk in my office.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so what we're wanting to do is make everybody comfortable so that they could actually confront issues in the same way. And he says, you know, you're right. If I'm upset about something, I come talk to you about it. And he says, this is a great program. Turns and walks out, and I go, shoo. But you just have to be honest about it. That was the truth.
Can I just talk about a slightly different angle on this, which is, and I think we really need to come back to the low wage worker. I think they're very much in the corner. But just for a second, there is another slide called this technology, which is the rat race that we're creating. Leslie, I think you've been doing some experiments in trying to get work-life balance by actually stopping the work.
Which gets to some of this. So let me just say a couple things. I deeply believe this is a collective systemic problem. And so partly we're having these conversations, and it is embedded in some comments. It's, well, we have to leave it to the team. But I think if we recognize, especially, and I think we have, back to Alan's point, we have multiple conversations going on here, and we have multiple aspects of the workforce. But in the part of the workforce that I study, which is very much the higher end, the professional service, the people who are on 24/7, who, when I said, well, let's try to change this, but let's not, I don't believe you can change it. So, you know, you said, well, the company has meetings on Wednesday, so I had to figure it out. Well, my response is, maybe, but maybe they don't have to have meetings on that Wednesday, and we just presume this is the way it has to be. I did some research that motivated all this. I went to China, India, and Hungary and studied joint ventures. Equally productive groups, and everyone told me this is the way it has to be and there's no other way, and yet they all did it totally differently. And yet so much
women do.
but so inherent is this assumption that this is the way it has to be, and now if you want flexible work then you have to figure it out, as opposed to, can we collectively think about how to do it differently? Can we own it? It's consistent with a lot of what you've done. And my experiment most recently is taking people are on 24/7, and I said, you have to take one night off a week. 6 o'clock, you have to give up your BlackBerry, you can't check in, there's no work, and this flipped everybody out. Because this isn't what's valued in the culture. And it's not just results, right? It's about, because how do we really assess results? So if we knew how to assess results, it would be one thing, but we don't really know how to measure results. So as soon as you're the person who's not working as hard, then somehow there's something wrong with your results. So I said, you're going to...
That's my point.
That's right. That's my point.
And so we said you're going to leave at 6 o'clock, one day a week. And this was really meant as a catalyst to cause them to engage in trying to build trust, trying to create conversation. I don't care if you want a night off or a week, and most people didn't want it, especially if they were in Minneapolis or somewhere else where they didn't have family. And they said, well, you're undermining what I'm all about. I said, I want you to work collectively and see if it's possible. And in doing that, it was amazing how it forced them to rethink how they did their work. And they do get a night off, and actually it turns out people, even the workaholics who work 24/7, who thought they were going to be disadvantaged and thought this was completely not what they wanted, to the T, everyone can tell you, it's not bad to have a night off. But nobody, I mean, it's amazing how people don't even think that way. They don't think they want it. They don't know what they're going to do with it. But much more important to me is that that was a catalyst to create space for people to have a conversation about how to do it differently, and to recognize that something as simple as a night off. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, they would sit in this room, and now it's become a global initiative for them. They would sit in this room and say, the night off is here nor there. What it's done is create trust. It's create open dialogue. We can now engage in collective experimentation. And it's all about collectively engaging in these experiments. And I just want to keep that in the conversation, that if you leave it to the individual to figure out how they're going to have the flexibility, especially in these higher-end jobs, that's a tough thing. I mean, a client is going to call. Things are going to happen. And so we have to think, how are we as a group going to back each other up and make that work? It's just some of your hospital examples, too, and the people figuring that out together.
I think you want to
I wanted to comment on this, you know, will they fail if they don't do it voluntarily? And, you know, there is a whole slice of American business that is basically on the low-wage road, you know, low-wage, high turnover. And for a company that doesn't value low turnover, they don't have much incentive to do these things. And so I think that's where the need for mandating comes in. Looking at
I actually agree with you. I think the issue on low-wage, I think it's very important
to
talk about that.
And if you look at figure four, it's very interesting which industries have the most flexibility. And of course, your industry, Jim, other services, professional business services, financial activities.
What page? Where are you?
Page 9, figure 4. And even manufacturing is about in the middle. And what is the worst industry of all is construction, which is a heavily male industry. But the next one shocks me, although I shouldn't be shocked, education and healthcare. Healthcare, of course, the schedules, the patient demand, you must be there. But education, an economist, Robert Draco, who actually now is on the JEC staff, he did this great study that showed that teachers have the most inflexible jobs.
That's
true. If you can't just leave work and go see your kids' performance in another school, you should be in the classroom. And I'm wondering, you know, we're all concerned about the quality of education. Well, maybe it's because education is way down here in the bottom.
That's a good point.
In terms of offering their work flexibility. You know, it's always a great job for women. You get to go home early and you get a summer off. Well, that's about the end of the flexibility. You know, you're grading papers all night and you can't leave work. You just don't leave your classroom. Very, very rare to leave your classroom. So I think that it just gave me an idea for how we could improve the quality of education after looking at the spring grant. And I did want to mention there are some laws that could give workers the right to ask for flexibility. And I actually brought copies of these reports because they're so small. And it's a review of statutory routes to workplace flexibility and cross-national perspective. And, you know, they've been called soft-touch laws or right-to-request laws. And I've heard that the Chamber of Commerce has complained more about these laws, the potential possibility in the U.S. than even the Health and Families Act, which is a mandatory up to 7 days if they say 4 day family care leave. I think that was a great thing, by the way, that Senator Kennedy's staff did, was to add to the paid sick days the ability to care for your other family members in that 7 day minimum requirement. So anyway, there is a legal way to encourage these recalcitrant employers, including our school systems, to provide their
flexibility. You mentioned a right request. So Guy was just this morning talking to me about, right, so Britain has, this is their policy, and we have a sense of how it works. So as I understand it, you have a right to request. The firm has a right to say no. But are you going to tap on this, or? You get to go to court.
Nan, do you want to talk about it?
I mean, the way my understanding of the system works is that you have the right to request a flexible work arrangement. The employer does not have to provide that arrangement, but has to engage in a dialogue with you about that, you know, provide a reason if they say no. And one of the key things that it provides, especially for the low-wage worker population, is protection from retaliation. Mm-hmm. It is to say you absolutely cannot be fired for saying, can I take every other Friday off or something like that.
But you know, nobody feels free to do it. It's like sexual harassment. You know, it's so hard to actually charge sexual harassment. You know, it's just really
I guess is the
do.
Question. I mean, so in a place like Britain, where is there? Does it change the culture like
Jane Waldfogel has a book coming out tomorrow, and she's here, and I can't quote her.
Only she were in
she's not in our group, but I believe that she's. I haven't read her book, but I've read the blurb about it. That she's found that it has results, and we could ask her later. But I believe that it has been effective.
Just having the right request has increased the number of requests by a huge amount.
Huh.
And so I think
that
there is some protection. A lot of private companies in the U.S. actually have these as well.
Citigroup doesn't.
Yep, and I think that there are universities that have these. And
the EEO lawyers in Britain, defendants, they thought, oh my God, this law is so stupid. Well, it's not going to do a darn thing. Well, yeah. But they shocked that it actually was
different.
You know, Britain, like most of Western New York, has a culture of worker protection.
Yeah.
And a lot more unionization, and a lot more. Laws that protect workers in general.
Well, but see, that's why I keep coming back down to the bottom line thing, because I read some study recently that did say that even for low-income workers, that bringing someone new in, if someone leaves a job, is cost about $40,000. So that's more than you're paying this worker. And so now you've got the hassle of losing the worker, finding another worker, training another worker, and paying the money. How could that be a smart thing for a company?
That's what James was just saying.
If
the turnover is incredible.
If you
but you were saying that there's some companies that don't care, but it seems to me that they would just...
If you don't value employees...
It costs $40,000. It costs more to hire the wage person.
Well, we brought together a group, and this is in the early 90s, we brought together a group of employers of low-wage workers, although they didn't want to be called that, as you can well understand. And they called themselves the employer group. And they met for 8 years. And in the beginning, they really didn't see the cost or care about the cost because they thought there are always people out the door and maybe someone else will come in who will be better. And they know, you know, we had studies then that could talk about the cost of turnover of a worker in different industries and so forth. And I think that it took a business-to-business discussion to bring about change. By the end of even a year or two, those companies began to see that there was a cost to turnover, even in jobs when they hadn't thought of it. But they wouldn't have learned it from us necessarily. They learned it by, and I'm not kidding, they learned it from each other's experience, which is why I think this dialogue is so important, and that goes to a point that I wanted to make about what Jim said, which is that even within the companies that are recalcitrant, that have difficult, and with any good company, you'll know that you have bad bosses too. I mean, you know, your surveys all show that. That a business-to-business discussion really makes a difference, and we found working on the community level that by having businesses talk to each other, that they can begin to see that it can make a difference. So I think that the general to whom it may concern business case may not work as well as real specifics from a peer whom you trust and a structured conversation, as we're talking about with the Right to Request Act. The best companies, the ones who often win the Catalyst Award, et cetera, have a process for staff evaluation or for performance review or whatever that builds in a structured conversation so that you're entitled to have that discussion about what how you want to work and when you want to work and where you want to work and how you want to progress and what the company needs and those sorts of things.
Athena,
you had
something?
No, I was just going to add to, you know, this discussion. I, too, believe that, again, having the policies in place in the company, that it's very clear to all what the policies are around flexibility. And again, you know, because that's written. And the other pieces, I just, you know, I think you could bring those bad companies to the water, but we can't make them drink it necessarily. And that's why I think that they have to be mandated in some way. And you have to look at laws in which can mandate what they do, and it's in small steps. We talked about Europe. Certainly, I mean, when you think about, I mean, I had some stats I didn't know we'd get in, but 177 nations guarantee paid leave for new mothers. The U.S. does not. 177 nations. 74 nations guarantee paid leave for new fathers. The U.S. does not. 132 nations guarantee breastfeeding breaks at work. The U.S. does not.
Actually, so, the health care law.
Well,
yes,
we do now. Oh, okay. So that's good. We just passed with the new law. Okay. See, I've got to update that. Finally, we're coming. We're being enlightened here. But I mean, we look at so many other nations that, you know, aren't as progressive. You know, we should be leading the way in many ways, and we're not.
I was wondering, you're from Glaxo, is this right?
Yeah, that's
and
correct.
I think you also, like...
Just listening intently, yeah. Just soaking it all in.
Well, I was going to say, now, can you tell us some about what sort of policies are in place there? And I think, like, you had a...
Sure, we're probably
retirement
one of the,
and various things.
Yeah, leading companies in this area. We had a CEO when we were Glaxo Welcome at the time, that said, look, we just want to hear from the employees. We want to make sure we're implementing everything we can to make your work environment the best that it can be, whether it's child support, daycares on site, whether it's health facilities, whether it's anything that we need to do, whether it's disease prevention coverage and our benefits, anything we need to do to make your life, your beneficiaries' lives better, we're going to do. And I must say that over the years, we've stuck to it. Whether you're based in North Carolina or based in Philadelphia, we have over 100,000 employees worldwide. We're probably in every major country in the world. I can't think of a time where this has been an issue. We're constantly listening to our employees, constantly improving our programs, anything, whether it's flexible schedule, whatever it may be, whether it's nursing rooms or longer leave time after you have a baby. We're constantly listening and adjusting, readjusting to be sure we're meeting the needs of our employees. And obviously that has a tremendous benefit on morale. And, you know, and I think the commitment starts at the top. If our CEO sets the tone, then everyone falls in line. And I'm just pleased to say that I work for one of the better companies in that area.
Have you seen the problem, though, that was like Don talked about, of the sort of middle managers being a problem?
I know for a fact that we do reach out to support staff or maybe lower level earning employees. It's really hard for us because we're a manufacturing-based company, and that's our business. And as Mr. Conan pointed out, if one person is off the line, that really impacts our ability to be productive. So we really try, again, to listen to our employees and really try to implement the best way we can to really meet the needs of our employees. But it hasn't really been a major issue. I'm not in HR, and I would reserve the right to come back to give you a different answer.
You also have a wonderful program where you have teams get together to teach resilience. This is a health promotion program, in how to deal with the issues that Leslie was talking about in terms of overwork, and then an individual process. So you have a structured problem solving and conversational process that I think has been really important as a support to the flexibility that you have at GSK.
Yeah, and like I said, it really starts at the top. It really, our CEO sets the tone. Our U.S. president is a fantastic woman, Deirdre Connolly. We win all sorts of awards each year, and I really attribute that to listening. We don't dictate. We really listen to our employees and really try to implement what's best and what's more efficient for them and their families. And obviously, they're more productive that way. So.
I kind of represent a different perspective because I'm a small business. In one hand, we can do whatever we want to do. We can have whatever policies we want to have. Yes, there are costs. Yes, there are trade-offs, whatever. But we can make a workplace that is embracing of our employees. On the other hand, it's a microcosm of every issue that all of you have talked about. It's every issue is an individual rather than a collective. Family leave for pregnancy, an ill spouse where the woman has to take care of that or the man has to take care of that. Parents, resources to solve problems. And you know, obviously a lot of women, we feel like control, we can control things. Somebody on the panel this morning talked about control and how we as women think we can solve every problem that's out there and that we can do this because we can. And I think one of the missing pieces for employees and employers is resources to help employees address problems when you don't have a huge HR department and an EAP and those kinds of things where we don't have access to some of the things that you all have talked about. We don't know where to go to find help for when we have to take care of parents. We don't have help for what should we be doing with breastfeeding in the workplace? Should we be having a policy? Shouldn't we have a policy on something else? And there are not a lot of resources that are collective that we can go to a couple of sites. We don't know. So I think that would be an important part for the growing small business sector, and you talked about that earlier, that this is where a lot of businesses are going to be in the next, some of the larger businesses are smaller than they were, unfortunately, but this is where a lot of that's going to be, and we do need the resources to help.
It's also one of the benefits of the bigger companies that are often overlooked. Everyone's talking about how to create all the small businesses. Well, we can create environments that can really help people manage their lives better.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have scale, we have presence,
yes.
We have employees.
That's really something.
And all of the capacity of an organization, a larger organization.
Yeah.
I somehow feel it's discounted as we get into talking about everybody migrating to smaller, more agile organizations.
And just to add to that, just to add to that, I mean, folks look at us, we are a manufacturer-based company, we have a lot of field representatives, but we do create and develop and cultivate small businesses. I mean, we can't run our business ourselves, we depend on businesses to support our needs. And we can impart our knowledge to them and help them create a structure for their businesses to be able to better support us and to be able to better support their employees. So I think it really is, I think when you think of corporations, you don't think of that aspect of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And it's, I mean, we face this with the auto industry, right? We think of it as the big two, and then suddenly it's a giant supply network, and most of those are very small firms.
Right.
So I actually think this idea of, you know, that's a natural way for information to flow.
Exactly.
To have some
and we can provide mentoring opportunities.
Yeah.
We can, you know, help them build the base that they need to be able to support corporations and to keep their business alive and grow. So I think, you know, as you go down the road, you may want to consider
that. I know Karen Mills is running one of these, the head of our Small Business Administration. But one of the things that they do is to use people that have gotten the Small Business Administration loans, become the mentors for the next generation. And I think you know, one of these ideas of, isn't this an issue that can be on there?
Yes.
We ought to talk about the federal government, right? One of the biggest employers, one that doesn't have a paid maternity leave. So anyway, what do you...
Well, I'd like to talk about a couple things. No, we don't have paid parental leave. People think that the federal government, they just think of us as having good benefits, when for the most part it's true, but it's not always as extravagant as people would make it sound. So paid parental leave, you know, that's something that we'd certainly like to see. There's a bill in Congress, we're working on it. There's a few ways that that the government really isn't doing a very good job in terms of these flexibilities. We represent about 5,000 nurses in the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they have the ability to have alternative work schedules there. We can bargain over it, but the agency doesn't do it very often. Sometimes they have a lot of our nurses, obviously, are women. Some of them are single mothers. A lot of times they have to work mandatory overtime if the case arises.
Sure.
You know, they have a child out of daycare. They have to get there, and if their boss says, you've got to work overtime, you know, if they leave, they're insubordinate and they could be fired, and there's no recourse. So a lot of our nurses just leave, you know, especially the young ones. So, you know, it's a major problem. You know, we'd like to be able to bargain over those sorts of things. You know, like you said, a lot of times unions can help put these policies in place. So that's one area. Another thing is for telework. Whenever the snowstorms were a couple months ago, we have 400,000 government civil service workers in the D.C. area, and they lost a week of work, which equated to tens of millions in lost productivity. If we had the telework, if we had that system in place for them to do it, we just wouldn't have lost that productivity. So that's another thing that we, you know, really like to see happen. But to see
CC
government
has
people
to
beat
say
on.
Because we did some research on this.
We did some research on this, and actually because of the gains that at least the executive office of the president has made in terms of the telework, you know, we think of it also as the working at all hours. But during the snowstorm, it did save the executive office of the president, I think it was $30 million a day. And so over 5 days.
We all just kept saying it doesn't take a terrorist to shut down.
Actually, I mean, the CEA is one, actually, in the previous administration, they bought laptops for everybody. And we got the economic report of the president out the week of the snowstorm. We got every memo to the president. We got our daily briefing to the president because everybody just logged in. And as someone said, this is the best test of our terrorism response mechanism, which is we didn't miss a beat. And I was unbelievably impressed.
You talk about doing things differently. I saw a blurb, I think it was in Sunday's Times, about Inc. magazine was doing a cover story. I think it's on the newsstands now, on sort of the future of offices and the officeless future, and they published a whole magazine with nobody coming into the office.
Interesting.
And you think about it, you're trying to see that. I haven't read the article, but they said, okay, no one's coming in. And so they all were like, you're suffering terribly. You know, how are we going to do this? And it worked just fine. And so this can happen.
I'm curious, though, with a client-based business, because you're always hearing from people who are in client-based businesses, we're at the whim of the client, and particularly the big clients. They call and say, show up in Denver Sunday, and show up in Denver Sunday. I mean, is that...
It's balancing the high-performance culture to client demands with the realities of people, because guess what? Every one of these clients are made up of people, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand this the same way that we do.
And
you know,
Cookie, I would say, too, from our end, that we could talk a little bit about getting our employees' creativity. Our customer service center, so our team of people that take the orders from the supermarkets, the mass merchants of the world, you know, they're staffed around the clock, so if Walmart needs soup, we're able to send it as quickly as they need us to. But that team actually came up with the most creative solution so that certain members of the team could work at home one day a week. They'd all come in on Wednesdays, and then at the end of the month, when we close our months out, they'd all be in the office. But it's an idea that the team themselves came up with, and by far one of our more critical work groups, I would say. And so through their creativity and innovation, they were able to develop a solution that worked for them, that worked for us, and still meets our customers' needs.
I think that's one thing that I really hope as you move this forward, you know, we sometimes drift away from either the government side or the lower income side. I hope that there's a way to incubate a lot of creative thinking because, you know, no disrespect to all of us at this table and all of your staff, it's the incubation of ideas are going to come from all sources that's going to really be positive, I think, in making this work. But
and it was Eleanor said that one size doesn't fit
right,
all. Right,
and she's spot on. The other thing I'd encourage you, just flipping through some of this, is from our perspective, it was really helpful to separate flexibility from flexible work arrangements. Because inevitably, you know, men will mush those together and it becomes a very gender sort of conflicting thing. More of our women than men are on, you know, this table you pointed me to is all about flexible work hours. All of our people need flexibility.
Right.
And we actually have a lot of men on flexible work arrangements formally. We actually promote a lot of people to partner on reduced work arrangements, but we actually talk flexibility for 100% of our people, not just for those people who might want to work 30 hours a week instead of 50 hours a week. And so they're really different issues. You got to confront both, I think.
That's the key, because then nobody says it's unfair.
I guess there are two thoughts in my mind. One is the officer of a bank that I interviewed once, a vice president, who had agreed essentially to give up 20% of her pay so that she could be out of the office one day a week, but was so eager to have that she agreed essentially to continue delivering the same results.
Exactly right.
And the other thing I'm thinking about is the labor movement and how hard and how long people work to get the workday down to 6 days a week. And I'm conscious of the swampy territory here and how eager people are for flexibility and control and the help that many people need to do exactly what you were talking about managing the upper bound. We have a lower bound here we're trying to manage so that people can take a day off work without losing their jobs. There's an upper bound too, where we can't expect infinite results. That will have a negative effect on the health of our nation. And I don't know how we navigate that, but I sure don't want to lose sight of it.
Yeah, right, so everybody's working at home, but they're not talking to each other.
Well, and the thing that worries me, especially in the context of this new office and the idea of technology, is then we start creating this expectation that people are on 24/7,
right,
7 days a week, and we lose sight of what's even a work hour anymore.
Exactly.
And I think technology.
Yeah.
I completely agree it's happening. And yet, I mean, it's an interesting question for you, one that we've been wondering about, is what is work anymore? I just did a survey where we actually asked a huge set of people about, you know, how many hours do you work a day, and how many hours a day are you on? Monitoring, right? And people no longer know. So I'm at a kid's soccer game, and I'm on my BlackBerry, and I'm, you know, am I working? Am I not working?
Right.
And it, this whole fuzzy notion of, you know, we're busy reporting work hours, but what is a work hour anymore?
Yeah.
I think it's...
Which is,
getting
I think,
into dangerous territory.
Yeah, why we need to pay attention to the whole issue of the health. The work-life field has moved toward the notion of work-life fit rather than work-life balance to connect it with fitness and health. because we believe so strongly that how, where, when we work really affects our health. It's not just the economy and the business case, but we really feel that it affects our health, and we need to pay attention to what Shelley just said, the upper boundaries and the lower boundaries, and the health for both, because the lower wage workforce actually has more serious, and even having 5 paid sick days affects your health.
I just want to add that flexibility, you know, isn't enough. You have to have that paid time off, and one time is the parental leave for parents in the federal service. You commented that now at Ernst & Young, your turnover rate is the same for women and men. Well, in the federal government, it's 31% higher for women of childbearing age than for men
Eternal.
Of the same age, yeah. Turnover. And so the government, our federal government, is probably losing 31% more women than right. It needs to. And we did calculate that if we had the rental leave, we would at least eliminate some of that disparity. But it's a claim we will eliminate it all. But it's also something that men need. I mean, paid time off is kind of the other side of flexibility. You know, you need flexibility, and you need some way not to work all night and all weekend. We need some control on this. I don't know what it's going to be in this new environment, but. You know, there's paid time off, and then there's time off. You need both.
And there's 60% of Fortune 500 companies have a benefit for paid leave for the birth of a child or adoption.
Oh, of course, yeah.
60%, well, but yet the government still does.
Well, not just for mothers, but also for fathers, yeah. And also for adoption, and also for us. So, yes.
I've always respected but not really liked the term work-life balance, because it always implied, as one who's a little bit of a workaholic, that I'm giving something away to get the other. And so, you know, the term you use sort of works better for me. You know, we're talking more like about work-life harmony. It involves health, nutrition, fitness, a whole host of other things. But the other thing, the number of hours aside, which is a real issue, and ultimately, a lot of that is, in a sense, it gets back to the good boss or bad boss and those sorts of issues. You can put all the policies out there you want, and it's what do people demand of you, and that varies. It's hard to legislate that in a way. You can try. But I think one of the breakthroughs that we found is, for a while, everybody was focusing on how do we put tools in place to make it better so you can work when you're traveling, work at home, work at the soccer match. Well, is it okay in all of your places to pay your bills online at work and to use your technology for that? I mean, the technology has to go both ways, too. Right. Otherwise, it's just a trap. Yep. And you can't, I mean, candidly, it's been happening at work for decades anyway. We just act like it doesn't and make it more difficult. So how about tools that facilitate that allow those things that you need to do to carry on in your life that you can't check at the door okay to do during your downtime at work? Because if you have downtime at home for work, it seems like you ought to have some downtime at work for home.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. There's and young people today, the youngest workers are coming in with their mobile devices, sure. And they are chatting and Facebook, and they are
if we think they're
absolutely
not.
They're checking. They are not always checking the email from their manager or their client, and they are really pushing us as executives to look at a different way. And I think we should also be looking at them and what they're going to expect. They're all not in the same mode as we were, and as some of the younger people around here are. They're really looking at work in a somewhat different way. And we have to really pay attention to that.
I completely agree with you. There's another perspective here, though, that says if we want to compete, we have to perform, and we have
yes.
to work hard. This is how
yes.
the country was built on the back of 24/7 work. I mean, rare in society in the Midwest. You know, you woke up at dawn, you worked all day until dusk, and then you rested and got up and did it. We're competing globally now. The people that we're competing with are fanatical with their work practices, and so we can talk about balance, but we also have we call it work-life integration. We call it work-life harmony. We don't believe there is a balance. It's like you know, we believe that's like waiting for Godot. So I just think the other side of this coin, as we contemplate this, is it's a performance-oriented world. And we've got to work smarter and everything else, but there are a lot of hours in that work. And we're competing with countries where people are willing to devote those hours for a lot less and competing with us. And so we do have to just acknowledge it's a performance-oriented world and we have to be competitive too.
If I could add a cute story on that, you know, a number of years ago I was sitting with about a half dozen Indian CEOs. We've got a big practice in India. And one of them looks at me and says to me, Jim, it's very curious. He says, you know, we understand that it's against the law in France to work more than 35 hours a week. He says, you know, here in India, we're trying to figure out if it's possible to work 35 hours a day. So it's exactly to your point. It's a very difficult world we're competing in.
Now, this is That's interesting because the data point I have is that we work more hours per year than any of our competitors. And I'm concerned about more than working stupid rather than working smart. I used to be in the computer industry. You'd have a guy sleeping under their desk.
Yeah.
Concept, we're going to have a program. When you're really working stupid, it like puts up a light, go home.
We have to work smarter. I'm just adding some texture to this.
That was my point at the beginning, though, is that because of globalization, that our productivity and competitiveness will be affected if we do not have workplaces where women, the people coming out of college, all of that, feel that they can do their best work, give their best talents, and be able to stay there.
Right, absolutely.
And I would propose that the 70-hour work week is inappropriate for most people for much of their lives. There's a small window of time, and there's some really interesting people that love it for a long-range plan. But, you know, that's why, you know, custom fit is what we came up with.
I guess my point would be you don't want to go to 35 hours a week in France. There's a lack of competitiveness in some cultures as we've gone too far. Now, I'm not saying we're going too far. We have to be smarter, but... we also have to compete and go out around the table and talk about this. There are 20,000 people back in Campbell's trying to get the work done to compete. And it's just part of the discussion.
My data on your, you know, it's not numerical, but from traveling the world constantly, I have very little work-life balance, integration, or harmony.
A wonderful life.
But it's a great life, really.
But do you have a custom fit?
Well, I don't know. But my data is we actually work a lot more hours than continental Europe, Western Europe, and we probably work fewer hours than many emerging markets. And so I think it's a mixed bag right now.
Right.
But I think if you look at the data, the laws and basic policies that most countries in the world have far exceed ours. I mean, Arlene was meant to, we are far behind.
There is a legislative agenda here.
No question.
Right. But I think also, like, if you look at examples, for example, like immigration, we used to do a lot of our agriculture by bringing tons of low-wage, grossly underpaid people into this country, and in many cases we still do. When we put a stop to a lot of that, what did? We innovated, right? We developed more mechanized agriculture. I mean, like, part of what happens is if we keep draining people and using human capital all the time, we won't innovate and we won't keep up.
Yeah, and let's
see. So I just want to add one thing, which ties the technology to some of what you were saying. I absolutely agree we need to work hard. I'm not trying to debate that at all. However, I think we create a lot of our own problems, not even at the country level, inside our organizations, right? For every email you send that someone else has to respond to, and we create spiraling this out of control. The data actually shows on high end, right? So the managers and professionals, that work hours are not that different, but that we are on significantly more. We are much more responsive. We feel much more pressure to engage. And they may be going there next, but there's a lot of pressure that we're creating. Absolutely. It's culturally inflicted, right? And that's something that we could really work within an organization to address.
Sheena, I was just going to say, this whole issue, and that's a whole other subject to itself, but this whole productivity, The stats absolutely do show that Americans, we are most productive, and our productivity has continued to incline since 1974, in fact, to the present day. But yet, we also see a decline in our real wages. And again, that is having an impact on particularly women are seeing an impact on wages. So, I mean, as we're talking about this productivity, it is a fact that we are most productive, wages are going down, we're working more hours, but getting paid less for those hours worked.
And as I was going to say, I think you had very much the perspective that Cece was raising about sort of low-wage workers. Do you have any additional insights and sort of going forward? I mean, where I want to go with the last few minutes is thinking about policy, right? Is it enough to just provide the information and trust the market? Is there research that needs to be done? Are there statutory things?
I think that people need a web of support. Low-wage workers are often in very precarious positions. They have the reverse, I guess, of workplace flexibility, and that oftentimes they go into work, and this week they're working this schedule, and next week they're told that they need to work a totally different schedule. And so they have to be able to make those changes in their personal lives, which becomes very difficult for them. And if anything pops up, then they're caught in this very unenviable position where they have to make that choice between family or work responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And if we are a society that truly, truly believes in this idea of putting families first, then it makes sense that we would then have laws that back up those ideals.
Absolutely.
And it's really a shame that we are behind 170 countries across this nation when we like to purport ourselves as leaders of the world. So, you know, I would say that low-wage workers are working hard. And they work a lot more hours than it even looks like they work in terms of what they're actually clocking in, because oftentimes they have to rely on public transportation. You know, oftentimes they have several bus transfers, for example, that they have to go through. So the time that they spend with their children are very minuscule. So whatever we can do in terms of helping not only their workplace flexibility, but also helping things with things like transportation, with things like childcare expenses, all of those things are important, that we really look at this in somewhat of a holistic perspective and not just in one specific area.
And Christine, I do think there are policies we need to be thinking very hard about. The information about the 170 countries, I was given the same information coming here, that we're in such a steam company with Papua New Guinea, Lesotho, and Swaziland among the bottom handful. And so we clearly need to do some things policy-wise. We also clearly need to make sure we let, you know, private companies innovate and incubate, and we find ways to encourage both the governmental sector and the sort of lower wage sector to incubate around solutions as well.
This is not a policy, but I am struck so much by the fact that we live in a global world, and one of the things we need to teach people from children on is to understand the perspectives of others, because so many times the roadblock to the incubation, innovation, teamwork is you can't understand, if you're the boss, how that person took all those buses to get to work and you think that she's a slacker if she's late, but you don't know that her bus was late. And so I just think that we need to help people learn how to, that's not a skill that just comes naturally. We need to teach that as a part of management training, business schools, elementary schools, wherever. Perspective leadership, I call it.
Cece, do you have any last comments?
I don't.
Anyway, I mean, Guy, have you gotten it all down? Because we're going to have to. This has just been, I can't thank you enough. It has really been just fabulous. Our job is going to be to bring this back to the president, and as the first lady explained, this is a passionate issue for both of them, and so we are really honored that you are here. And so with that, let's break this up and head back downstairs, and then we will actually get to hear.